we'll start off with where and when you were born.
I was born in England, 1917, and I came across to Canada when I was 1 year old. Brought up in that in Winnipeg. When I was the age of 16, I took my apprenticeship for a butcher and worked there for a couple of years until I joined the Army.
What company was this with?
I worked for a small butcher shop on Winnipeg here called Jimmy Husband's.
Mm-hmm. And what was your father's occupation?
My father was worked in a Dominion Brass in Winnipeg here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what schools did you attend in Winnipeg?
I went to the Wellington School and I went to Daniel Mack.
And can you tell me, were you in the militia before the war
started? No, I wasn't.
Okay. Can you tell me, when did you enlist?
The war broke out in 1939, I should say, not 31. I joined the Army.
Okay.
Joined the Winnipeg Grenadiers, and I was in what they call the first reinforcements of the Grenadiers. I took a bit of parade square drilling, and right after that there was some trouble in our battalion of where there was thievery going on, and there was a battalion butcher and a few more of them that were raked over the carpets for it. And the first thing I know, I was called in off the parade square to report to duty in the kitchen and as the battalion butcher. And I was the battalion butcher all the time through the Army.
Whereabouts was your training done in Winnipeg? At what barracks was yourself?
At Port Osmond Barracks.
Okay. The Grenadiers went to Jamaica in 1940. Can you tell me a bit about the trip, like how you went?
We left here on the second dispatchment. We went and from here to the coast, and it seemed to be about 2 days out that we traveled, or 3 days, which all the ways across, I was still working. I had to go down into the hole of the ship and drag out the frozen meat and stuff and cut it up as I was going across, helping out aboard ship. I was let off with a part of our group in Bermuda. And I think I stayed in Bermuda approximately about 6-7 months, which I was still a battalion butcher and stores. My job consists of, in the battalion butcher work, was to go and draw rations from the Imperials, bring it back to our own camp, divide it up among our own different kitchens, our sergeant's mess, our officer's mess, and which also include the Imperials. Soldiers, their wives that was there and everything, and they all had to have their rations of meat from our outfit, which the meat was all frozen solid, had to be cut with cleavers. There was no bandsaws or anything like today. You just had to hack off a hunk of meat the best way you could.
Why were some of the Grenadiers let off in Bermuda?
There's two detachments. We were split in two. And I believe that there was the Jamaica had half the English regiment there when our first lot arrived, which was through government orders that we were let off in Bermuda and stayed there till we were relieved about maybe 6 months. And then we left Bermuda and carried on to Jamaica. Jamaica, I had the same job, only a little bit different, bigger, being the whole battalion being there, different kinds of food. We'd have to go out every day with a fatigue party down to the docks and turn around and pick up bananas, oranges. If a banana had one ripe banana, the whole thing was rejected and turned back to the Army. Training down there was nothing. It was garrison duty, which was very strict because we were under the Imperial then. In fact, as far as I was concerned, it was too strict because I've known of cases where some of our boys, in fact, one of our boys, had 30 days detention because when he was being inspected on guard duty by the Imperials, his cartridge of his shell of the ammunition wasn't shined, so he got detention for it. Web equipment, which has been treated for gas and everything else in the field of action, they had to be scrubbed. They were scrubbed white instead of brown the way they're supposed to be. When we come back from Jamaica, all that equipment that we had had to be thrown out altogether because it was no good to anybody anymore. The Imperials have had you wash them, and you washed all the gas resistant and everything off of them. And when we arrived back here, we arrived back, I think, in October or November. We got off the train, and they made us march out onto the streets, which was cold to us, in our tropical dress and shorts and putties and stuff. A lot of our boys took sick. Orders come out after that where they were to wear their overcoats in the city, and we were the only battalion that was allowed to wear overcoats at that time of the year yet.
Okay. Now, when you came back to Winnipeg, you were given leave, a furlough. Now, what did you do during this time, and what was your reaction when you were called back?
I just don't remember too much about it, but I believe the furlough what we were given wasn't very long. If I can remember, it was only a matter of 14 days or something like that. And then we had to go back to the barracks again, which was the old Robinson building downtown, just around Notre Dame, somewhere around that district there, which was an old, old building. It wasn't fit even to keep a dog in. The floors used to slant and run away in certain directions. If you spilled water, there, it would run all to the one end of the building, just like a funnel. Conditions in the barracks there were out of this world. Should never let nobody live in a thing like that. And yet we were put into it.
And you were called back before the furlough was actually up, and then you were put on a train.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was your feeling at this time, and were there any rumors of where you were going?
Rumors were that we were going to Enamel, B.C. to train, as far as what everybody was had in their mind and their rumors. But when we were issued tropical dress, we knew we weren't going to Enamel. We were going to go somewhere else, into the Far East somewhere. And first thing we know, we got off the train. Well, in fact, on the way down to the coast, we were losing 20, 30 men between every big stop. And they'd have to reinforce the battalion again with a bunch of other youngsters, I will say, kids that were only somewhere about 16, 17 years of age, who'd never been in the Army. And aboard the ship, they put us aboard the Awatea. That was an Australian boat. The men were aboard that, and it stayed there for one day or two till they found out that there was too many of the boys jumping over the side of the boat, going down the ropes, and going to AWL. So they took us out into the harbor in the boat for how long it was, I don't just remember, maybe a day or two, but it just circled out into the harbor that nobody could get off of it till we were met with some other troops before we went over. The equipment that we had on the boat, they were trying to train some of the men. It was just broken down Becker's machine guns, some new guns which weren't enough to even give the men the training. They never did get much training aboard ship anyhow. On the way across, there was a U.S., American I should say, a submarine come up between us and our destroyer. And they never even knew anything about it till some of our own men that were on guard, on ship guard, saw it come up and notified them that there was a submarine that come up between us. Then they declared it was an American submarine.
Were there any stops made along the way between Vancouver and...
Yes, there was a stop made at Hawaii. And we pull up into a dock that I didn't know where it was, but I knew it was in Hawaii, and it was right in front of the where the big pineapple water tower was. In fact, I even checked back on that just not long ago when I went to that dock. It was Dock 39.
Okay, what was done in Hawaii? So just a refueling
station? Hawaii, they turned around and just refueled the ship. On the dock, they brought the girls out onto the dock. They gave a hula dance there in their grass skirts and that, but there was nobody got off the ship. You watch it through the portholes and the top of the ship. That was all.
Was there any other stops made along the way?
Not that I know of, no. It was just Hawaii and then Hong Kong.
And was there any announcement ever made on your way to Hong Kong of what your destination really was?
I think that we were told after we left Hawaii that we were going to garrison duty in Hong Kong, and we were relieving the Imperial troops there. But we found out after we got there that we weren't relieving the American troops. We were being attached to them and building up their strength in Hong Kong.
Okay. Your arrival in Hong Kong, what was this like?
The arrival in Hong Kong, it was just more of a laugh than anything else. The ship pulled into harbor. There was a bunch of sandpans and everything all going around the ship itself. We were taken off the ship and we marched to the barracks. I think it was the name of the barracks now. I just forgot right offhand. One Shampoo, I think it is.
Shampoo.
Shampoo, that was it. And I carried on my own duties again as battalion butcher in that place, which was quite a difference because we had a bunch of Chinese help. Chinese was cooking. We had to supervise it. And it was something that you wouldn't get used to right out of a sudden, the change of the diet and everything else, which you had to take in rations for the Chinese help and rations and everything for ourselves besides.
Mm-hmm. What type of food was served?
The food that was served there was actually it was not too bad in certain ways. We had the beef, which was still frozen as ever. Your bacon, they turned around and they sent bacon, I believe it must have come from England because it was whole sides of pork that was smoked, and they called that the bacon, which was moldy. When it come to us, you had to scrub it off, use vinegar and water and a scrub brush to take the mold off the bacon. In fact, I complained about it to the officer on duty there several times that I never saw bacon back in my life. There was Major Hook. I happened to serve him in business here in Winnipeg before we even joined the Army. And I explained it to him in certain ways that this kind of stuff you never saw back home. I says, we've got 3 grades of bacon back home, but by Christ, this must be 10 grades lower than that. And training in the place, there was no time for training, actually. The time they got used to it, there was only about maybe 15 days or so. They took a few of the boys up onto the lines. The Japanese were over on one side of the, looked more like a, could call it a, really a football field, because the Japanese lines, you could see their trenches on one side and you were on the other side. In fact, the men were calling out to one another all the time. And we did not know that they were such experienced troops as they were. We found out afterwards that they were the Japanese guerrillas that turned around and was fighting in that country for 10 years before we come up against them. And they knew just what it was all about.
Was there any time that there would be some type of, it looked like a beggar outside the camp? Things, and then later on you'd find out it was a Japanese officer?
Yes, we've turned around and we found that out, that he used to have batman. That would be like a Chinese houseboy that would come into the barracks and they'd clean the barracks up for you. They'd look after your equipment. That was the imperial way of what they were used to, of having a servant looking after them all the time. And we just turned on and fell into the same shoes as what they were wearing. We'd let them shine our shoes, and you'd pay them maybe $5 a week, which was Hong Kong money. I think it was 10 to 1 of ours at that time. So you weren't paying them very much. But then there'd be fellas around the outside of the camp at your huts and that. They'd be selling stuff. Find out afterwards that the fellas that was doing this begging and batmen and everything else all around the camps and that, which were there before we even pulled in there, they were in the Japanese army.
The battle itself, where were you when the bombing first started and what was your reaction to it?
Well, the bombing itself, when the planes come over, I was in the butcher shop. It was a small square building just about in the middle of the barracks. The planes come over and started bombing. Everybody was running all directions. Most of them were running to the quartermaster's store to get ammunition, because we were never issued ammunition till the war had broke out at that time. At least not us, it was in the garrison all the time. Then I believe that we were taken from there and we went across to the island, to Hong Kong itself. This was Kowloon that we were stationed in, I believe. Then we went across to the island after that when the fighting and everything all started breaking out. In fact, we had to come across, I was on one party that we had to come across and act as rear guard so that another company would get out. I think that's about to cover that end of it there.
What were your actual duties during the battle?
Actual duties during the battle was the same as what it was through the earlier parts of the war, in the peacetime and the wartime. I was the battalion, still the battalion butcher and stores. I had to go out to the ration dumps with the trucks. I'd have fatigue men with me that would do all the heavy work and that, but I'd have to go and get the rations, food, canned stuff, biscuits, and the meat and that, and then we'd just pick an area more or less away from everybody, and I'd have to start dividing this stuff up and breaking the meat up into different pieces and send it out to different companies. And then their cooks would take it from there and prepare the meals for the men.
Mm-hmm. Where were you? Were your headquarters set up on the island then after the battle started?
After the battle started, it was on the island, yes.
Whereabouts on the island?
One Chai Gap, I think.
One Chai Gap,
yeah.
And was it in a private home?
There was, seemed to be, I don't know whether it was a private home or it was an ordinary building. To me, it seemed to be it was more of an office building affair or something like that. It was a low one-story building, which I was, my quarters was in, and I worked out of there every day.
And how were the meals sent out to the different men?
Well, the meals sent out to the different men, you've got me there. I mean, you mean individually.
Mm-hmm. Like the different... different groups were at
well, different groups,
parts of
you
the
see,
island.
They were sent on the truck from our ration dump, where I was working, where I'd be working that time, and it would be slated for maybe A company, B company, C company, and them trucks would take it away to their companies there, and their men would have to look after their own cooks and everything, they'd have to look after it there. Mm-hmm. But they'd have to come to me to get it to start with.
Okay. Did you maintain your headquarters at Wan Chai Gap right until they surrender and at the end of December?
Yes, we were stayed at the one place, and I can remember then where I was on a Christmas day, I believe it was in the morning, at they had signed a kind of a truce. Signed, not signed, but agreed to between the Japanese and the Imperial Army and the Canadian Army that there would be no firing or any advancing till 12 o'clock or after 12. There's a certain hour set there. But the Imperials and that, they kept their word that they wouldn't be no firing or anything at all, but the Japanese, they'd advanced on us. They set fires to a lot of the docks or something down at the docks. It sent a smoke screen right across that you couldn't see them coming. The artillery that they had in the, on the island was all pointing out to sea. It couldn't be turned around. I believe there was just one gun it could be turned around. All the rest was pointing out to sea, and we needed the fire inland. And the ammunition that was being fired, every second one would be a dud. Your own ammunition, which you were firing, same average, it was duds. That ammunition and stuff had been there since 1914. It was never renewed.
And where were you when the actual surrender did come?
The actual...
How did you hear about it?
Surrender... We heard, the first words that we heard about it were, I think our company commander had sent word across back to Canada or through the wireless that the casualties were very heavy and they didn't expect to last too long. We then were told that would surrendered. Went out to pick up a load of rations again so it would have enough food to last them for a while, and we were captured on the ration trucks as we were going down to get the rations. The Japanese, they stopped us on the road and we were taken prisoner. We were taken back to a camp. I think it was back to Wan Chai Gap again, and they were around there maybe for a day or so, and then the Japanese guards had allowed us to go out again to pick up rations, because we didn't get rations the first time. On the way back down, I believe it was Major Hook that we picked up on the way down. Someone, their boys were taken, trying to get him down to the hospital. We put him on the back of the truck. I say the back of the truck because all it was planks. There was no cab on it at all. It was just like an unfinished truck. You get shipped in here with no cab. You were sitting actually on the gas tank, and your steering wheel and pedals were just there in the hood. That's all it was of the truck. So you made your own box on the back of it. Well, we got Major Hook, I believe it was down to the hospital. They took him in from where we were on the road, I believe, into the hospital. I'm not sure, but I heard that he died. I'm not just sure now. He had back injuries or something. And before we got to the ration dump, we were taken prisoner again and taken out to another place.
Where was it they take you the second time? Was it to another camp?
I believe after that we were taken on this march, and we had a walk from where we were taken then. I'm not sure just what world part of the island we were taken on, but we had a walk all the way down back to the docks and taken across to Kowloon side again, to our old barracks. I can remember on the way down that there was a lot of men that were injured. They couldn't walk anymore, and they just turned around and left them on the side of the road. They turned around and they'd put them back to a tree, and they'd either bayoneted them there, or they'd turn around and they'd tied a piano wire around their neck and tied them back to the tree, kneeling on a round piece of wood. And if they ever fell, piano wire would tighten up and choke them.
What was Sham Shapoo like now, like after your return there?
Sham Shapoo, when we returned there, the camp, before we went away, had windows all in it, woodwork all around the windows, had iron beds with the, what they call biscuits on the bed, which is the same as what's on your sofa here now today. Say three of these would be laid on your bed. That'd be your bed. We went back, while there was electricity and everything was in the huts, we went back there, all the woodwork frame around the windows and everything were all gone, the doors were gone, and all the beds and everything else was gone. You were issued then with a straw mat, and you laid that right on the cement floor, and that's where you'd sleep on the cement floor. The fence around the place, they electrified it. And in fact, it must have been pretty strong, because there was once or twice there where the dogs had tried running into the place, and it be electrocuted in the fence. We had a kitchen which we set up. I believe it was back where the old kitchen used to be, and there was nothing in there. The Japanese had turned around and issued bags of rice, nothing else to go with it, no salt or anything, nothing at all. Nobody knew how to cook rice the way that you're supposed to eat rice. Everybody in our battalion and everything thought rice was to be eaten like a rice pudding, which was the wrong thing. That caused a lot of water in your system, caused beriberi. That was actually all that was good for was somebody that was sick. That was all, but not in our condition. They brought flour in. The flour was scraped up off the streets, which was used for sandbags before. The Japanese had taken it from our own ration dumps and used it as sandbags on the street. Everything was mixed in it. There was hair in it. There was dirt in it. It was lousy with weevils. But the thing is that you had to try and use it. So there was no ovens or anything in the place, so we had to build our own ovens. And how they went about in building the ovens is some of these iron beds and stuff with the angle iron on, you'd lay them on some bricks, you mixed up with a mud paste to make your bricks on the sidewall, and you'd run these angle irons across, and you'd lay bricks laying on the angle iron, and you put the next angle iron back to back and the same way across. But we make a two-decker oven out of that, and it's all right. We only had flour, which was lousy flour then. But what can you do with just flour with no yeast or nothing to make it rise? So we tried every kind of experimenting that we could with a bit of vegetable, anybody had anything around the camp that would be in a fruit of some kind or a beans or something to get it to ferment. Well, at last they got a hold of somebody that was making up something. I don't know whether it was for them to drink or what, but they found out that this would ferment, and we used it. Well, after that, we kept up this sourdough by adding more flour to it all the time, and we were making buns with the bread we had, flour, I should say. But, oh, it was black with weevils. We tried straining it through sifting it through ordinary screen, but these weevils are so small, they'd go right through. Well, they never liked the looks of it at first, but you got so you could eat it. In fact, I can remember the medical officer one day getting all the men out on the parade square and telling them, now look, he says, do you boys all want meat? And he says, there's meat there. He says, that's not going to hurt you because it's been in the ovens of 300-350 degrees. So he says, there's not a thing in there that's going to hurt you. So they got by the idea afterwards of being weevils in there. They pretend it was raisins or something.
What other type of food did they
serve? Well, they used to burn us in sweet potato tops, just the stems and the greens off the tops. Another one they used to burn into is what they call daikon. That is a radish. It's about a foot and a half long. But no matter what you'd done with it, you chopped it up, put it in water, and boiled it. But there was no salt or nothing to go with it. And you used to have a bowl of rice a meal and a bowl of this goulash soup that you could try and make up. The odd time, that would be in Japan. That would be after they shipped us out of there, they took a couple of working parties away. And they'd march you out on the parade square first to see how well you could walk. And if you could walk good enough, they took us then to Japan itself. And on the way across to Japan, I believe the ship had to stop into Formosa. Formosa, the ship itself, was all garnished. They wouldn't let you off the ship or into the harbor. You had to stay there till they turned around and took certain lots of tests before you could leave there to go on to Japan. One of them was a stool test, which in our country and in the other country, if they want a stool test of a person, they'd turn around and ask for it, and you'd give it when you had time to pass your ball movement to get it. But not with them. You just lined up in a whole lineup aboard ship, and when you get before the medical of their people, you used to drop your pants down and bend over, and they'd hit you with a bamboo with a swab on the end of it. Whether they got it right or not, you'd never know, but it nearly killed you when they done it to you.
Back in Shamshapo, what was the sickness like?
Sickness in Shamshapo, it was quite a bit of sickness. It started away with, I believe the start of it was malnutrition. That wasn't very strong to start with, but they had this diphtheria, which broke out in the camp. And we lost quite a few men there to start with. And in fact, now I can remember that the butcher shop, which I operated out of for the few weeks that I was there, that was turned into the morgue afterwards. And I also had the job then in that camp of helping was with the dead. they'd bring them in. They were died to start with somewhere around 100 or some odd people a day out of the, not just our regiment, but all the regiments that they brought in, the Punjabs, the English, and everything else they brought in there. And the coffins which the Toronto brought in to us to put these people in, soldiers I should say, were way too small for them. You had to turn around and bend their legs under the body to put them in the coffins. You'd march out with the coffins in the morning to bury them on this side of the hill and come back into camp. The next day you start going out with some more. The ones that you buried yesterday were dug up. The wooden coffins were taken out and the bodies were just laying there. The Chinese were taking the wood because wood is a scarcity in that country.
What about medicine?
Medicine, there was just a bit of medicine of what the medico had on their own possession when they were taken. There was no medicine given in from the Japanese at all to help us out for, not to after we got into Japan itself. I can remember I had a toothache and I had to go to the medico for it. And they had nothing to pull out a tooth with or to do anything there. The only thing is what the medical officer, or the dental officer, I should say, could do was to drop acid into this decay that the head to it was killed. The nerve was killed, I should say. I can remember he dropped some on the side of my lip, and boy, my lip just burnt right up.
What about organization? Was there still some type of an organization in the ranks?
Yes.
When you were in Camp Chicot?
Yes, there was. They had the officers across on one side of the barracks, and they had men, had the privates and the corporals and the sergeants all on the others. They had actually in the camp, it was ran by our own officers and higher ranks to try and keep up the morale and pick up jobs for the boys to do just to keep themselves occupied, because there was no going out to work or anything in San Francisco.
You didn't go out of the camp at all, you were kept strictly
in the camp. You were strictly in the camp, and of course there was no there was the cooking going on and that, but actually there was nothing for the boys to do there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
By the way, there was. They were taking out working parties to rebuild again the airport in Hong Kong. And they had to rebuild that by taking stones and stuff. They were carrying the Yoho poles over their shoulder with a basket on each side to rebuild this airport.
Now, you were mentioning before about going to Japan. Were you on the first draft or the second draft?
I was on the second draft going to Japan.
Okay. And can you describe what the ship was like and how many men were there?
The ship, I just can't say what size it would be, but I know the men were all in the hold of the boat. The only daylight we had was the top hatch would be open. The space that was allotted, very, very tight quarters it was. I believe after somebody of our officers and that had measured it out, I believe it was only a foot and a half to 2 feet wide by 5 feet long. When you laid down, you had laid down head to foot with one another. So you'd have space enough to lay down. The toilets, there was no such thing. They turned around, they arranged afterwards for buckets to be up on the top deck, which you could go up if you got permission from the Japanese guards to go up there. There was an operation that had to take place aboard ship. One of our boys American, not our voice, had appendix. And the doctor had to turn around and operate on him. The doctor had in his sole possession for his kind of work, he had one can of ether. They got nearly everybody upstairs, and they had kind of wooden life rafts they put down in the center of the hole, and they spread out some kind of cloth, I don't know where they got it from, and they fed this fellow the ether. The doctor operated with a razor blade and spoons or forks, and he made the incision in the fella. They bent spoons with a curve on the end of it, and they had someone hold each side while the doctor went in after the appendix. He sewed this fellow up afterwards with ordinary thread. Well, it was a miracle. He'd come through good, and he only had an incision on him about an inch and a half, 2 inches long afterwards.
What happened at your arrival in Japan, and where did you arrive at?
We arrived at, it was a big city. It was not when we arrived though. We were putting on to electric trains. In fact, it must have been around where they did the big bombing. Because all you could see as you went through the town, or the city it was, all you could see was these big smokestacks up in the air. Everything else was cleared out, it was flattened right out. We were taken then to Niigata, Japan. Niigata, Japan, we were on stevedore work and coal yard work. Everybody had to work. If you didn't work, you only got a little bit of food. Actually, we all just got a little bit of food, but they got quite a bit less. In Japan, I was working in the kitchen. And we had to turn around and cook up the food, the rice and vegetables. That's all you got down there, too. Later on, and the time went on, we got other kinds of food, such as grasshoppers, they'd bring in fish, double hammerhead shark. You'd eat all that stuff. Grasshoppers, the boys used to have to go out in the fields with the big nets, and grasshoppers used to fly up into the nets. They'd take them and they'd bring them back into camp. And then when you get into camp, they'd turn them over to us in the kitchen. We happened to have at that time some soy sauce, a bit of sugar, but not too much. You used to turn and get the soy sauce and the sugar boiling in the big vat that we'd have there, and you just dump the grasshoppers in it. They'd be dead after they hit that anyhow. And then you burn them out and you let them dry off, and you give them a few grasshoppers for their meals. Meat, we never saw no meat, not to the end. And it was a rough diet. We lost a lot of boys over malnutrition, mistreatment, and they had to work hard. If you didn't work, you weren't fed. If you were sick, even on the job, the Japanese just used to say to you many a times, they said to you, Morsukoshi mate chizo hakona, which meant in Japanese, pretty soon you will be cremated and you'll be put in a small box. And they used to laugh about it. There was another incident that happened in the cookhouse there. Japanese commander, which was responsible for 100 and some odd deaths, 165 deaths, of our boys was in the camp. He was brought up afterwards on trial, which was supposed to be insane and put away for years. And Nissen was brought up there with him and I through our own government here. Is at one time in the kitchen, in the cook shack. He called me to attention one day when the Japanese guards were all there and our own people was working the cookhouse. And he started pulling my mustache because we didn't shave. The tears come into my eyes. The Japanese were all laughing, the guards were laughing, he was laughing. And like a big fool myself, I called him to attention in Japanese, and he stood to attention, and I started pulling his mustache. Everybody of the guards were laughing, and he was laughing, but the laugh soon ended. The work party had come home, and they opened up the big back doors, just like two big garage doors, and the work party saw me doing this to the camp commander, and they all started to laugh. Well, he got mad, and he went over to the stove, the firebox where we had coal in there, and he took out a shovel full of red hot coals and held it under my chin. Many a nights after that, he'd call me, but I never answered him. I was never around, boy. And after we come back here even, I was at home in the house we lived in Winnipeg here, and some of our officers from Fort Osborne Barracks, intelligence officers, I believe they were. They come up, asked for me, and they took me out to Fort Osborne Barracks. They asked me about this incident that happened. I says, how did you know about this incident? He says, one of the fellows that saw it, his name is Barlow. So I told him the whole story, how it happened and how it backfired. I said, well, that makes no difference about that. What you've done to him is what he was doing to you. So it wasn't long afterwards that they sent me back a photograph of him and told me that he was insane on the trial and he was put away for years, but I don't know what happened to him after that.
What about the sickness in the camp now? Is it getting worse?
Sickness in the camp was getting worse all the time. There was diphtheria that broke out. In fact, I was a carrier. They found out after quite a while. And we were put away in a different part of the camp, separated from the rest of the people. We were fed more than what they were, because being a carrier, as long as you kept your strength up, you couldn't spread the they did, because they were feeding me among a bunch of other people. And in the camps itself, they had kind of a hospital set up there. There was no medicines really to give anybody. They couldn't get no serum in for any of the diseases that they had. It was just time. If you had anything wrong, throat, such as when the diphtheria broke out, they used to have these here pills in the army that used to put in water to soak your feet in for the calluses on your feet. The doctor gave you a couple of those and tell you to dissolve it in water and goggle your throat with it. And there was nothing to help them along one way or the other. They tried their best to cure everybody, but what can you do if you've got nothing?
Did you do any other work, like in the coal mine itself, or did you strictly stay in the kitchen?
No, I worked on what they called Maruzzo. That was stevedore work. We went out there and you were unloading boxcars to the ship, and you were loading from the ship to the boxcars. And lots of times we'd be loading stuff into barges, your Japanese oranges, many a times they'd go through, and even while you're carrying the bag on your back, you had a hole in the bag and you had an orange out and into your mouth before you passed through the size of a garage. We used to be unloading beans, and we knew just what kind of work it would be in. One day we'd be back at the next day, and what we do is wear two pair of pants. And on the bottom of the pants, we used to tie them up around tight on the bottom. We used to take a bamboo shoot along with us, maybe about 5 inches long, and which is hollow, the bamboo shoot is, and taper it off like a spear on the end. And when the guards weren't watching, we used to just go right up to the bag with our body, push the chute into the bag, and let the end of it flow into our pants and fill our legs up with beans, and we'd walk home at nighttime with a pant load of beans. There was another thing which we used to steal quite a bit, would be on the corn, but there wasn't any goodness in it at all. It was after that, taken all the oil and everything out of corn, there'd be a waste product. Actually, it was made up in a kind of size of a wheel, and we used to break a lot of that off and take that back, but I guess it used to fill us but didn't do us any good.
Were the men ever caught stealing the beans?
Oh yes, they were caught, and they'd be hit over the head with a rifle or beaten severely. Made go without their rations when they got back to camp, and they were treated rough if they were ever caught stealing.
How many times a day were they fed?
They were fed 3 times a day, but it would be just the same thing every meal. One small bowl of rice, which you get, and all your rest, your soup bowls here, leveled off. And another one with the vegetables cooked up the way I told you, with no salt or nothing in it. Mm-hmm.
And you were at this camp right until the end of the war, were you?
Right to the end of the war. We were out on the marching to work one day, and I believe it was somewhere around August the 15th, and I believe it was the B-29s that come over, and they dropped a bunch of pamphlets down, which we got a hold of. And it was stated on there the Japanese people had overthrown the government or something. And we were only at work for maybe about an hour, and we were taken back to camp again. When we got back to camp that night, they changed the guards and the camp commander and everything that night. And then we were told that the Japanese had fallen. And it was a matter of a few days after that, and the planes were coming in, our own planes were coming in off the American carriers. They found the camp, and they went back away from us again. About an hour and a half later, the planes come back again. The bomb hatches were opening, the torpedo hatches were opening, and out of the hatches were coming kit bags with everything that the American flyers and that, I guess, had of their own personal use, they were dropping to us. A few days later, the B-29s were coming over. They were really dropping stuff, parachuting it down, opening the bomb hatches up and parachuting down. Would come groceries, peaches, pears, milk, chocolates, everything that you could think of. And they were in 2 45-gallon barrels welded together, and the ends just had cross boards on the ends of them. The odd time that they wouldn't open up, the parachutes wouldn't open up, and they just come down straight. Bang, everything went all over the place. Well, a few days of that went on, and we had way more stuff than we could use. And we knew we were going to get out. We were told that we were going to be taken out such and such a time. We went up onto the roofs of the barracks, the huts that we had there, and we took the old parachutes. There was lots of parachutes there. And we put signs on top of the building. Oh, they must be about 15 feet high and about 4 or 5 feet wide. Stop drops to the Air Force not to drop any more stuff. In fact, when the drops were coming, the Japanese guards that were still there to protect us from their people, because they wouldn't give us any arms at that time, they even opened fire on their own people when they were trying to get our rations. This is how things changed in that one time. On the way back from there to the carrier that we were going to go on, landing ship I should say, aboard the train, we were fed very good. I guess about the best the Japanese could feed us that we were fed. We were taken aboard the landing craft carrier, and we were only supposed to be there till there was enough men that they'd take us out in the B-29s and fly us back home. And they had to wait for the hospital ship to come to take the wounded off, ones that were very sick. The American landing craft was loaded, and from what I hear after we set out, is that they pulled anchor, pulled out on their own. Our hospital ship, they passed in the night. They knew it was there, but they passed on because the American boys wanted to get home too on that ship. Well, I think we got into one other island, Guam or somewhere, I don't know just which it was, and we had to go all through medical again. And the filling is full of vitamins and everything else. And then I think the next stop we had after that was somewhere in Amu, BC. And then we come back from there to here by train. Or you could take a plane if you wanted to take a plane. If some of the boys did take a plane out.
Niigata camp, how many men were in the hut?
Niigata camp in the hut would be, double-decker. They had a row of bunks all on one side, and same on the other side, and upstairs would be the same way, but it'd be all open in the middle. You just climb, would be going up into a barn with the floor taken out. And I had, as far as I'd say, there'd be somewhere about 60, 70 men in the one hut.
And were they all Canadians, or was there Americans or British there too?
In our hut, I think the Canadians, they kept by themselves.
But was there also other nationalities in the camp?
There was other nationalities in the camp, sure. There was the English was in there, no Punjabs, so there'd be just the English and the Americans. And Dutch, because there were some of the boys off a Dutch submarine that was in there too.
And did you receive any pay while you were in the prison camp?
No. The first money that you ever received was the board ship coming back, and it wasn't pay. It was money given to us from the Red Cross. I think it was $5 or something like that. And then after our first paid, we got a board ship coming back. They gave us so much money. But the deductions were right there, $5 to the Red Cross, to give back to the Red Cross again out of everybody's pay again.
What about camp interpreters?
There was one camp interpreter. He was down in Niigata, Japan. They called him Shiga. It's spelled the same way as Chicago. In fact, I think the right way to say his name would be Shiga-san, because it's his mother's name, you see. And his folks was taken prisoner on our coast. And he always figured that the way he treated us was the way his parents would be treated here. But he was very good. He'd warned us of a lot of things, and he didn't like the way the Japanese were doing things. He was good. In fact, I learned a lot of Japanese from him, and he was learning English from me.
When you got back to Winnipeg, what did you do on your arrival? Were you given leave again?
Yes, I believe that we were given leave when we got back here and a can of powdered milk and a box of vitamin pills. And I think we were given leave for, I don't just remember how long it was that we had to report back. I think we had to report back every day back to the barracks, and they give us vitamin shots and everything pretty well every day that we were home. They give us leave 30 days. That 30 days up, they give you another 30 days. In fact, I think when I was discharged, I think it was back in 1946, that when they were going over my discharge papers, that was the longest that those people that was giving me, that was given the discharge, had come across anybody that was drawing trades pay from one time to the other right through.
Did you return to work as soon as you got your discharge?
No, I was off work for quite a while afterwards. I think maybe about 6 months afterwards before I was able to go to work, because I'd picked up in the camp, I'd picked up what you call anemic. I believe that would be the right word for it, dysentery. And that is, after, when you had that, in the army even, you couldn't handle food anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can remember, brought back my memory a bit, that was the reason why I was taken out of the cookhouse and I went on to Maruzzo on stevedore work, because I'd picked up that dysentery. And every day we'd back here, we'd go down to the hospital. There was nothing much really going there. They'd give you a shot in the rear end and send you back off again.
And when did you return to work?
I returned to work, I think it was somewhere about the end of 46, I think, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. I returned to work, and I started working then for, I worked for a fellow on Westminster. He advertised for a butcher, and I went there to work. He was a very nice fellow. Bernard was his name. And he hadn't had a holiday for years. So I was working for him for about 2 months, and he decided he was going on a holiday. And I said, well, I'd like 2 weeks off when you come back. He said, well, I'll take 2 weeks off before I go. So he went away on a holiday, and then when he come back, he was sick in bed when he come back. He hit his leg on the boat or something, wherever he was, and he got what they call lisphorbitis. And he died right after that, and the shop went up for sale. In fact, I wanted to buy the shop. I tried to get backing. I did have backing. But his wife found out that I was going to buy it. So this refrigeration guy, Davy Bell in Winnipeg, he was going to back me. And she wouldn't sell it to me then, because she knew what I was wanting. And I'd ran the business for 2 or 3 months. I had it in my own hands, even the whole thing. And another thing which made it very tough on us when we come back is that you couldn't get life insurance. No matter who you went to, they wouldn't sell you insurance. They'd be wanting to sell you. Soon they found out what your history was. All you had to mention was Grenadiers. I'm sorry, we can't take you. I was very fortunate. 14 years ago was, I had a fellow bothering me quite a bit. And I sure I'll take insurance from you. But somehow or another, it went through. But I'm paying an awful big premium on $5,000. I'm paying $20.90 a month. And that's twice as much as anybody should pay on a $5,000 premium. And that's the only insurance that we could ever get a hold of. And it's the same thing, like, after now we've been back, this house, I bought it, at least on payments of my own, after I learned that I could take the house on government, on a lower percentage of for interest, I sold the house to the government. I bought it for what was owing on the house, $6,000. I bought it back from the government for $6,000. You're supposed to be able to have got mortgage insurance if the companies would pick it up. I paid them 1 year in advance, plus 1 month, gave them a check for it, for the government to send away. Wasn't long after do I get my letter back, checks back, and my letter back. Sorry that I wasn't accepted for mortgage insurance. And for $6,000, they wouldn't go for 15 years. It kind of makes you think, why? If they say there's nothing wrong with you, I'm going to say that, that you're going to die right away, how come they won't stick their neck out for 15 years for anybody? Of course, I believe the whole thing is that there's so many of them dropping dead, and they found out it was some heart trouble. And yet some of them that had a medical examination yesterday, for instance, were dropped dead today with heart trouble. It's not right by no means.
Yeah. So where are you employed now?
I'm employed now with the Dominion Stores. I'm a butcher in the Dominion Stores. In fact, before that I was in business of my own. After I left this fellow that died, Bernard, I went out in the country, the huts of Manitoba, and I invested everything I had, which wasn't too much money, somewhere about $5,000-$6,000. An old building was there, it was a double-decker building, was old. I had everything on payments, all the equipment in the store, all but a few thousand dollars of groceries. After I was there for about 9 years, or before that, I had paid for the building, cost me $3,000 for the building. I remodeled the whole building itself. I made a 5-room modern suite upstairs. I extended on the side of the building, twice as big as what the original building was. I put all oil heat into it to heat the whole thing. I had the building finished remodeling on the 18th of December, doing a wonderful business all the way through. January the 31st, we're on our way into Winnipeg here to pick someone up at the St. Boniface Hospital. We were stopped on the road on the way in at Toulon, that our building had burnt to the ground. So I come back in Winnipeg. Had a heck of a time with the insurance companies because they never give you what you pay out for insurance. I settled with them anyhow, and I bought a business on William Avenue called Santon's Grill, a restaurant. It was a very good business. Anybody that was in good health and nerves were good, which mine are shot, would have made a gold mine of it. But being having 8 girls there working, some days they wouldn't come into work. The day you didn't need them all, they'd all be there. So one day 3 of the girls didn't show up and I was sick and tired of it all. I got mad. I got on the phoned the real estate man. He was down within an hour to get all the particulars. In the afternoon, when I was still mad, he'd come back with a buyer to buy the place off me, so I had to sell it. So, after that, I was supposed to be there for a month till the fellow took over. Dominion Stores had advertised for meat cutters, and I answered an ad to them, and I was hired. And I've been working with them since now. That's going on 13 years now.